The following three-part podcast is provided by CALM, the Committee on Archives, Libraries, and Museums, a joint committee of the American Library Association, Association of American Museums, and the Society of American Archivists, under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. For more information, go to creativecommons.org. Part 3.
The following podcast was produced for CALM, the Joint Committee on Archives, Libraries, and Museums. I'm Lee Reifenberg, a member of Group C in the 2010 cohort of the American Library Association's Emerging Leaders Program. Our group was honored to have David Ferriero, Archivist of the United States, as our inaugural podcast guest. A long road has led Mr. Ferriero to his current position at the National Archives, from his naval service during the Vietnam War to shelving books in the MIT Library to high-profile positions at Duke University and the New York Public Library. He has gained a wealth of experience and a unique perspective that continues to inform his work as the chief collector and protector of the record of the United States. We discuss those experiences, his role at the National Archives, and his views on the future of libraries, archives, and museums when we met in his office in Washington, D.C.
To switch gears a little bit here and talk about your role specifically here at the National Archives and some of the programs that you're working on right now. We'll start with the Electronic Records Archive, and that's been a top priority of the National Archives for several years now. The website says that there's a pilot program that's going to be bringing ERA to roughly 30 federal agencies by the end of fiscal year 2010. What's the status of the pilot project?
It's actually going to be 2011.
Okay.
It is, let me just say that it is the most visible, most important technological project that we are working on, and it's one that I'm most concerned about in terms of getting it right. Every agency here now has started experimenting with electronic records. There's no coordination of that across the agencies. Everyone is basically doing their own thing. Lots of money being spent every year. It's around $80 billion a year on technology across the government, with, in lots of cases, little regard for the records implications of those technology systems that are being built upon. So we've got an issue here in bringing the records management and the IT folks together.
You've mentioned the implications for records management. What about the implications beyond the realms of records management? I'm thinking specifically of other types of cultural heritage institutions that might have electronic texts or journals or works of art. I know it was big news last week that the Library of Congress is acquiring the entire Twitter archive. I'm just wondering if there are any implications beyond the realm of
Well, for my agency?
Yes.
We're responsible for records. So unless it's a government record, it's not my problem. But let me just say, on the Twitter front, some of those tweets are federal records.
Yes.
So eventually, they will come to the archives. The Library of Congress may have the entire Twitter archive, but those that are federal records will eventually be part of the Electronic Records Archive.
And obviously, the management of electronic records is a huge challenge. I mean, like, there's no doubting that. At the same time, though, we're still dealing with the enormous quantity of paper records that are produced every year. So how do you think that the balance of digital versus physical records will evolve over time?
We are, just to give you some sense of perspective, we're bringing in 1 billion pages a day.
A day.
A day. We are still very much in a paper environment.
Okay.
And I think we're going to be there for a while. It's going to be a while before every agency has conquered the electronic record environment. It's further complicated by the fact that the archives is legislated by two sets of laws, the Federal Records Act and the Presidential Records Act. The Presidential Records Act in 1996 recognized electronic mail as a record. The Federal Records Act has not yet acknowledged electronic mail as a record. This is 2010. 2010. 3 weeks ago, the very first piece of legislation passed the House, EMPA, the EMPA bill, the Electronic Preservation Message Act. It's the very first time, and it's only passed one House. Right now, the guiding principle is print and save. 2010. So we have some work to do.
We certainly do, especially since Earth Day has just passed us by.
But isn't that startling? 1 billion pages a day?
That's beyond anything I could have possibly imagined. Yeah. My goodness. Let's talk a little bit about the Open Government Initiative. And obviously the National Archives and Records Administration is central to that plan. And NARA's Open Government Plan is up on the website currently. For comment. What sort of feedback have you been receiving from the public?
It's been pretty positive. In fact, I just came from a meeting with our researcher user group to talk to them about their participation in a couple of the open government initiatives. There's a fair level of excitement. We're talking about creating a wiki to capture this, what I was talking about, the Citizen Archive content, to create a wiki around that, and they had some great ideas about it. So I'm really pleased that there's this level of engagement. I think that our user communities, and let me just be clear about who they are. The genealogists are huge, the historians, the open government folks, like CREW, National Security Agency, Archive, and researchers in general have been looking for ways to participate a little more, to collaborate with us. So the Open Government Initiative is a great way of engaging them. For me, more importantly, it has been a great way to energize the staff because it's also focused on us internally and how we do our business in a much more transparent, much more collaborative, and much more participatory manner. So the creation of the Open Government Plan itself, for instance, was a staff-driven process. This whole open government thing is not something being driven from the top, but it's being driven from the bottom. Each agency was required to create an open government plan, which required each agency to get together and figure out how are we going to become more transparent, more collaborative, and more participatory. So in terms of a new guy starting here, it's a great way, you know, for me to put my stamp on the agency by unleashing all this talent in the agency to work on the plan. And the message that I have been conveying to everyone outside, it's also an important leverage for me in terms of my work with the agencies. You can't have open government unless you've got good records.
Very true. They go hand in hand.
Exactly. Yeah. I think our situation is very similar to what Robert Connor inherited when he became the very first archivist in the United States, that every agency was doing whatever they wanted in terms of their records. Some of them were stored in attics and garages and basements and not well kept, a lot of stuff missing, fires, floods, all kinds of damage, and we're in a very similar situation right now in the electronic environment, where we've got all of these multiple ways of dealing with electronic records and not paying attention to them as records. So we have the same kind of, I feel I have the same kind of mandate that he had when he took over.
You talked about the concept of the citizen archivist, but in terms of public outreach and citizen involvement and education, could you talk a little bit about your specific strategies for public engagement? I'm thinking specifically in terms of the use of social media or other online tools that are now at our disposal that we might not have had access to even 10 or 15 years ago.
A huge part of our audience, mission, stakeholder group, is the K-12 community. And this is something that I really am passionate about because I want to use the records as a way of exciting kids about their government, about American history. and about careers in public service, and there's a way of doing that through our documents. So we do a lot in-house with teachers and school groups in the Boeing Learning Center here. Lots of school groups coming through here, creating the same kind of environment on the web. We have a project underway called Docs Teach, which will provide access to a wide range of documents from the collection, as well as context surrounding it, lesson plans for teachers to use in the classroom, and also the development of communities of teachers to help us think about ways of using the documents in the classroom also, so they can share them with other teachers. So we're focused on a lot of technological ways of sharing the experience beyond the walls of the archives. And experimenting with, right now, with Facebook as a way of also engaging the community in the use of the documents.
In December of 2009, President Obama signed an executive order establishing the National Declassification Center. And how is the center going to make declassification more efficient?
It was December 29th.
December 29th of 2009.
Yeah. October 9th was the open government. December 9th was the open government. So the 29th.
December 29th of 2009.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is... NDC. I don't remember that well.
I'm sure you do.
This is a massive assignment to declassify more than 400 million pages of material by December 31st, 2013. So there's a deadline built into this. And this requires some kind of process that doesn't exist now. So we've set up the organization, hired, recruiting now the head of the center, and working to look at technological ways that we might address large categories of currently classified material as a way of expediting the process. It is huge. It is driven by the White House, and very much part of open government and transparency. The drive to reduce the categories of classification and to streamline the process so that there's more content that's available. You might be surprised to learn that in the 250 agencies in the government, there are more than 2,400 different classification guides in operation.
Unbelievable.
Isn't it? Who knew?
No. Oh. You've now worked in a variety of institutions, an academic library where you obviously spent quite a bit of time, as you said, a large public library system, and now a federal agency. What were those transitions like for you, and what did you take from each of those positions that you brought into subsequent roles?
I've been very fortunate to have worked in really great institutions, and have been, in all cases, very happy in the jobs that I was doing, and didn't expect to leave. So when I got the call from Duke, when I was at MIT, that was a moment where, for me, getting a sense of this new environment before committing to it, but feeling that I could make a difference, that I knew a whole lot already, that there was growth for me in the new environment, but that I could make a difference. And in all of my transitions, that's been key to me making the decision, that I had to feel that I could make a difference. And I think so far it's played out in my transitions.
You are surrounded on a daily basis, in one way or another, by 10 billion remnants of our nation's collective history, and you are charged with collecting and protecting them. Does that ever get old? Do you ever go through your day and that just sort of hits you full force, this awesome responsibility that you've been charged with?
I think it's kind of cumulative awe. You know, I started out at MIT, and I was at that point, one and a half million books. Maybe it was only a million. And I got to Duke, and we were at like 5 million. I remember we made the 5 million mark. And I went to New York Public, and we did 53 million at the New York Public, which was, oh my God, 53 million things. So what's 10 billion?
At this point.
I mean, they're spread out over, 44 different facilities from Anchorage, Alaska to Atlanta, Georgia. It's not something I even think about. I certainly think about the 1 billion pages a day and what I'm going to do with them.
I imagine.
And the most extraordinary thing, though, is discovering what we have here, especially here in this building and in College Park, in terms of the records of our history. It's just absolutely extraordinary. That etching on the wall over there is the USS Constitution, which sits in Charleston, Massachusetts, Charlestown, Massachusetts. It's a ship built in the late 1700s that I spent a lot of time on as a kid. And I had an opportunity last week to go up into the vaults and actually look and explore the logs of the USS Constitution during the War of 1812, and read the section of the log in 1814 when she sailed into Marblehead Harbor to get away from two British ships. A story that I had known about, since I was a kid, but there it was. So it's things like that every day that just make your jaw drop.
Has there been anything else that you've found in the vault or would hope to find at some point?
The Louisiana Purchase, the check with which we bought Alaska, $7.2 million, drawn on the Riggs Bank right here in Washington. And you flip it over and there's the endorsement from the Russians on the back. A wonderful letter from Annie Oakley to William McKinley, offering to supply 50 sharpshooter women to fight the war.
Wow.
Yeah, really great stuff.
It's amazing. Although it's still fairly early in your tenure here, is there any one big accomplishment or legacy that you'd hope to leave behind before you're finished?
I think it would center around the Electronic Records Archive. I think we have to get that right, and that would be certainly a huge contribution. But coupled with that is establishing the agency as the leader of the federal government in terms of how they treat their records. I think that's something that I would like to be able to point to.
Mr. Ferrier, thank you so much.
My pleasure.